sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 29. Today I have an interview with author David Levine, and we'll just get on with it. Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, David Levine.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so can you tell me a bit about yourself, who you are and your background?
Well, I'm 45 years old. I live in Portland, Oregon, on the west coast of the United States, and I have been reading science fiction since I was a pup. I grew up on science fiction. My father was a science fiction fan back in the 30s. I don't think he was a member of the Futurians or any of those other organizations, but certainly he was a science fiction reader back in the golden age. And so I grew up with Asimov and Clarke and Bradbury on the shelves, and some of my earliest reading. I remember reading the Heinlein juveniles when they were too sophisticated for me. I wasn't quite ready for them. And certainly I remember Have Spacesuit Will Travel. One of my favorite books at the time was Miss Pickerel Goes to Mars. I love the Danny Dunn stories, Tom Swift, that sort of thing. And I've been reading science fiction for my whole life. And I always harbored a secret desire to be a science fiction writer. I wrote quite a bit of science fiction in high school and college. And then when I graduated, I got a job as a technical writer, and writing any kind of fiction was too much like work. And so I didn't write a single word of prose for 15 years. I changed careers in about 1997 or so, became a software engineer, and when I was no longer writing prose but code at work, now I was suddenly able to write prose again. And so I started writing fiction at the age of about 37, 38. Yeah, so I started writing fiction again at about age 37. And in the year 2000, I had a sabbatical from work. My employer very generously gave you a 6-week vacation at the end of every 7 years of employment. So that was my 14th year of employment. And so I told my wife that I wanted to go to the Clarion Workshop. And this was a surprise to her, but it had been an ambition that I had been secretly harboring in my breast for all these years. So I went to Clarion in 2000, and then I learned an awful lot at Clarion. And then in 2001, I made my first sale, and I've been selling about 4 stories a year ever since. So I've sold something like 20 stories, 20, 22, 25, something like that, of which several have been reprinted in anthologies, year's best anthologies of one sort or another. A couple of them have won awards like Writers of the Future and the Phobos Award and the James Webb Award, and 2 have been nominated for the Hugo, and 1 of them won. And I also was nominated twice for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer during that time. So I've been amazingly pleased and surprised by the success I've managed to pick up in really only about 5 or 6 years of writing. But I think because of the time that I spend in technical writing, I spend a lot of time learning how to put sentences and paragraphs together, write things that made sense, grammatical punctuation, and write to deadline. All of these things are very important. So the actual production of words was something I've been working on for basically my entire life. I've only been focusing on fiction for a fairly short time.
Okay. So what's it like to win a Hugo?
Wow. I cried for joy. I have never cried for joy before. I was sitting there in the second row, and there's videos on the web of the Hugo presentation. I got it from Harlan Ellison. And Harlan gave this long speech about how important short fiction is, how anybody that thinks that the best novel Hugo is the big one is blowing smoke, and that the short fiction Hugo is really the most important one. And I'm sitting there going, you know, oh my God, I'm up for this major award. And then he tore open the envelope and he said, Levine, you out there? And I go, yeah. And he said, get your ass up here. And I teleported onto the stage. I actually I actually broke the stairs going up from the audience to the stage. I was moving so fast when I hit the stairs that the stairs were in two pieces, and the bottom part slid to the right by about 6 inches as I was heading up. And then I jumped on Harlan. I climbed Harlan Ellison like a spider monkey. And I had this, I had an acceptance speech that I had written, even though I was certain I was not going to win. And I read the speech, and it actually said right at the top, it said, 2006 Hugo acceptance speech, which will never be needed. And I read that line. I read the title starting at the top of the page, got a good laugh out of that. And, you know, I thanked the editor, and I thanked my writing group and all that. And then I got off the stage, and I was crying, and I was trembling, and it was just an astonishing thing. And I clutched that trophy to my chest and didn't let go of it for practically the whole rest of the evening. I've been a science fiction fan since I was a kid. As I said, I grew up reading science fiction. I've been attending science fiction conventions since 1977. I've been very active in science fiction fandom. My wife and I edit a fanzine called Bento, which has very nearly made the Hugo ballot a number of occasions. Hasn't been nominated yet. I've been helping to put on conventions, including World Cons, ever since about 1978. Fandom has been a very important part of my life for basically my whole life, ever since high school. And so I was so awed by the idea that I might be on that same list of Hugo winners with Asimov and Clark and Bradbury and Niven and all those other people that I read and idolized in my youth. And to be one of those people after having been at this writing business for such a short time and also suffering so many setbacks in the writing career. Writing's a tough business. And after all of that, after all of those setbacks and all of those occasions when I wondered who the heck I thought I was fooling with this trying to write fiction nonsense, to have such an astonishing validation was just overwhelming. I was totally not expecting it. I was totally unprepared to win, and it was just overwhelming to me.
Okay. Now, where do you get your ideas for writing from? Particularly something like Tick, 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 which is a bit odd, I thought, when I heard it on a skate pod anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start off by answering the general question, where do you get your ideas? What I always say is that ideas are like neutrinos. They come fleeting in from space, and all you have to do is be dense enough to stop one. That really, there are science fiction story ideas. You can't turn around without bumping into a science fiction story idea. You can be vacuuming the floor or hoovering the floor, and you can pick up some little thing that rattles, and you start to wonder, you know, what was that little thing? You know, was that some tiny spacecraft that was hoping to invade, and I just saved the world? And or you can be just walking down the street, kicking at leaves, and thinking about the patterns that they form, and whether there might be some meaning in this. The story, The Tale of the Golden Eagle. Let me give you an example on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Clarion, I'm a plot focused writer. The plot is the first thing that comes to me. Most writers, I believe, are character focused. But I'm definitely a plot-focused writer. And so I was sitting outside talking with one of my fellow students about plots, because she had a lot of trouble coming up with plots. And she said, where do plots come from for you? And I saw this bird flying by. It was a pigeon. And I said, take a look at that bird. You know, think about the idea about birds. You know, what is a bird? A bird is a thing that flies, you know, like a spaceship. What if there were spaceships that were birds? What if there were spaceships that were made out of birds? Think about the problems of having a living thing be a spaceship. What happens, you know, what happens when it dies? What happens if it retires? Think how horrible it would be to be a bird, to be raised to be a spaceship and to fly, and then to become obsolete. And from that little core of an idea that I made up right there on the spot, just about as fast as I told it to you just now, sprang an entire universe and a future history. And the whole thing just kind of fell into place within, you know, the basic idea was there within seconds, and then the plot that came off of that idea took about 15 minutes. I wrote it down, a little one-paragraph outline. Didn't get around to turning that outline into a story for almost 2 years, but when I did, I basically wrote it in one sitting. I cried when I came to the end of it. It was it hit me in a way that just about none of the other stories I've ever written have hit me. Every time I read that story in public, somebody in the audience bursts out crying. It's a very sad story, but it's got a happy ending. And then that story received a lot of recognition. And as I said, it was nominated for the Hugo. That was my first Hugo nomination. It's like, where did that one come from? Tale of the Golden Eagle was a story about the depth of time. It was a story that takes place in a far future with a framing device in an even farther future. So everything in the story is talking about how long, long ago, it's a fairy tale. It has the structure of a fairy tale. And the story is written in a long, long ago kind of a mode when the story, the time that the story is talking about is actually far, far in our future, almost unrecognizably far in our future. So I was basically just playing with the idea of something that took place in very, very deep time. And with the success that that story had, I decided that I would play with the idea of very, very deep space. And just as Tale of the Golden Eagle uses time and then time built on time to give the impression of an extremely deep time, what I tried to do in Tick, Tick, Tick was tell the story of somebody who had gone far, far beyond his limits. I had the idea of a traveling salesman who travels much farther than he's really prepared to go. And I wanted to do the thing of taking a person from Earth and send him so far away that even the places that he passed through between here and there are places that are too far away for us to imagine. And in this, I was really following George R. R. Martin, who in the period of his career between when he first got started and when he started writing vampire stories, he's had an amazing career. I love George R. R. Martin. During the early part of his career, he was writing science fiction stories, and in this amazing depth of space, you could just feel the billions of light years in those stories, and I was trying to capture that. And that's what that story was about. It was about a traveling salesman who traveled so far that he completely lost track of himself. It turned into a story about a man who basically dies of culture shock. And I don't think that it really succeeded in terms of being about that depth of space, but that's where it started. And it turned into the story of a guy, a salesman, a traveling salesman like Willie Loman. I actually did a research paper about Death of a Salesman in college. And so I had this whole concept of the salesman, the everyman, the person who represents anybody, and just kind of took that everyday character. I didn't give him a whole name. I only gave him one name. I called him Walker, talking about him being a door-to-door salesman. And he goes to a place that is so alien and strips away everything that makes him a human being, to the point that he finally goes native because he has nothing else to see, nothing else to do. And this intended to be a happy ending because he strips away everything that makes him a human being and finds at the core who he really is and what he really wants, because he never really wanted to be a salesman. I can't imagine anybody wanting to be a salesman. It's something that I wouldn't enjoy. And so when I had this story critiqued, I remember somebody to me that her father had been a salesman. He was selling the Java programming language, and she said that her father said that you have to want to die for Java. You have to completely commit. And so I made some changes to the story after that critique. I turned him into somebody who would die for Java. But the thing is that his core, he would not die for his product. His product was trying to kill him. And in the end, he became a person who recognized what was really important to him, and he gave away everything else to hold on to that little thing, that little bit of humanity, which was what kept him alive in a place that was so inhuman. And when I talk about a place that is so inhuman, I'm not talking about the alien planet. I'm talking about job.
Okay. My father is a salesman by trade, and he loves his job. Well, he's really good at it, mm-hmm. So I think that's why he likes it, but I don't know. I don't understand the appeal either.
Yeah, well, if you're the kind of person that really gets into that sort of thing, then, it's something that you have to do. And we all have our passion, and we all have our place, and sometimes it takes us a while to find it, sometimes we never find it. Every job that I've ever had has been exactly the job that I needed at that time. Every job that I've had has prepared me for the one after that. And so I've gone from being a technical writer to being a software engineer. Now I'm a user interface designer. I'm actually a user interface architect. I'm designing user interfaces for other people to implement. And it's really exactly the job that I've always wanted. And really every job I've ever had has been exactly the job that I always wanted. They seem to come along at just the right time. And science fiction writing is like that, too.
Oh, excellent. Now, one of the show's listeners, Jesse, over at SFF Audio, asked, is there a relationship between Tick, Tick, Tick and Jack Vance's The Moon Moth?
Oh, yes, there is. There is definitely a family resemblance there. Moon Moth is one of those stories that I read when I was a little kid. I remember exactly what the cover of the magazine that it was in was like. It was a picture of a Hugo-shaped rocket ship, as it happens, on a dry and desert planet, with these three-toed footprints leading away from it. It was probably an amazing. It might have been FNSF, but I remember it was one of the magazines in my father's collection. That particular picture had nothing to do with the story, but I associate the two of them with each other. And so, yes, there is an awful lot in common between Tick, Tick, Tick and the Moon Moth. I was definitely thinking about the Moon Moth as I wrote it. I was trying not to be derivative. Tale of the Golden Eagle is also a story that has a lot in common with an older story. Tale of the Golden Eagle is very explicitly based on the works of Cordwainer Smith. And the relationship between Tick, Tick, Tick and the Moon Moth is not as strong. I didn't put in any specific Jack Vance references, but I was powerfully influenced by that story. I've read it many times. And the idea of a man who thinks he knows what he's doing in an alien culture and is completely wrong and, you know, has this fact drummed into him very, very hard, it's atmospherically quite similar. It's about a person who is arrogant and goes into a culture thinking he understands it and is beaten into something else by the process. And I believe at the end of The Moon Moth, our main character does go native. I'm not recalling. It's been a while since I reread it. But there's definitely a connection there. A lot of my stories have been called old-fashioned, and I think it's true, you are what you eat. I grew up reading old-fashioned science fiction, and so I tend to write an old-fashioned kind of science fiction, but I like to think that I bring some new ideas to the table, because there's only a few different stories, only a few different plots, and I hope that I'm bringing some new ideas, and obviously the stories seem to resonate with some people. People that like classic plot-focused science fiction seem to like them a lot. A lot of people don't like them as well, but there's room for many tastes.
Fair enough. Now, on to a slightly more general question. How would you describe your worldview and take on the world?
I'm a rationalist. I'd like to think that if everybody just if everybody looked at the problem for any given problem, if everybody looked at the problem with a clear-eyed understanding, then given the same facts, everybody would come to the same conclusion, and there would be no need for anybody to disagree. Now, I know that life doesn't work like that, but my fundamental worldview is always that if I could only explain it to them, if I could only find the way to explain my views to them, you know, on any given topic, then they would see it my way, because I have reached my conclusions, my view of what the world is like and how things work, through a rational process, and I assume that other people should be able to do the same thing. I'm an atheist, and the strange thing is that almost all of my characters are quite spiritual. I've written a lot of stories about characters who have supernatural experiences. The main character in Tick, Tick, Tick is somebody who has a religious experience. He encounters an alien religion and basically adopts it as his own. Many of my other stories are about people who have religious conversions or people who have a spiritual experience or have some form of spirituality, which is important to them. I've been told that there's a lot of spirituality in my stories. So it's important to my characters. I think it makes them sympathetic. It makes them understandable. It makes them interesting. So even though I don't believe in these things myself, my characters do, and I'm comfortable with that. It's a funny thing. And actually right now I'm working on my second novel. My first novel is making the rounds, trying to sell. And in the second novel, all of the characters are religious. I have two main characters. One of them is a human who was raised by aliens, and this is an alien culture that has a very pervasive religion. They worship the black hole around which they orbit. And it turns out that the god in the black hole really exists. And the other main character is a human who's to this peculiar environment from Earth. And she and all of the people who come with her are members of a religious sect. And I can't really tell you why these things happen. They just seem to be the right characters for the situation. So I don't necessarily write the way I think, and I don't necessarily write characters that represent me, but I write characters that interest me.
Okay. Well, if people wanted to learn more about your works and writings, where would be a good place to find them and read them?
Well, you can go to www.bentopress.com, which is my homepage, my and my wife's homepage. Bento is our fanzine, and Bento Press is the name of the non-existent organization that produces it. And under bentopress.com, you'll find one of the first links on the main page goes to my page of science fiction stories. And there you'll find a list of all of my published stories. About 3 or 4 of them are available online. There are several at infinityplus.co.uk available online for free. Tick, Tick, Tick is still on the Asimov's webpage as of yesterday. There's no longer a link to it from the main page of Asimov's.com, but I have a link to it. It's still there, even though it's been unlinked. I have a link to it on my page, so that's one that you can read online. And then the bibliography there has a complete listing of all the places that the stories were published in. You can purchase many of the books that they were published in from bookselling near you, or if you want, you can track down the magazines. In some cases, they were only ever published in magazines.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, David.
Well, thank you for talking with me.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that interview with David Levine, and talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.